Thanks, Spike. I think. This is quite an experience here. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My home group's the Express Group. Nice. I love that. I got to bring that down there. And my name's Paul Efron. And I really want to thank the people that put this together. I mean, if this isn't an outpouring of love and service, because these things don't just happen because you want them to, and to see what's put into this is truly amazing. And I'm standing and I'm really humbled by what's out here. I have a blessed life today. And the most important people here are those people with the 4 days, the 7 days, the 9 days, and you are off the hook. You don't have to go back out there. And that's the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new or coming back, welcome home. Let us embrace you and love you on this journey of life. It's quite a journey. Quite a journey. You know, I have no idea where I'm going today with this. I'm in a pretty good place, so you might get the real wacko talk here. You might, I never know. But the one thing I can tell you is I got up this morning really excited about being here, about sharing what's been given to me. And maybe one person can take a little piece of it and go and get what's available here. You know, we're supposed to share our experience, strength, and hope. And I have a lot of all of those. I have, case you have a hearing problem, I'm from New York City. And I'm a product of the 60s, you know, the tune in, turn on, and drop out generation. And I did all of that. I sometimes flash back on my life and I say, how is it possible that in 1964, I was 16, and then we went to see the Beatles in Shea Stadium in 1965, and then I woke up 15 years later. I don't know. I don't know what happened. I often want to get a bunch of people that were from that era together, and we could put a big class action lawsuit against the remaining, if what's his name has any money left after his latest divorce, and because really somebody that's missing. I don't know what happened. I had a lot of role models in my life, too, and one of them was my dad. I come from a real good family. I mean, middle-class Jewish family in Queens, New York City, and no alcoholism, no addiction in my family. And I had a father and a mother. They loved me to pieces. They wanted the best for me. They didn't drink. They didn't fight. They didn't, I mean, it was just a normal, like a Leave It to Beaver thing almost, except I was Wally Cleaver, whatever. Wally, whatever his name was. I was like, in the big book, in the 12 and 12, they have these terms, and I smile when I read it. I love the part, I think it's in the 12 and 12, it talks about an index of maladjustments. Well, the bottom line is I was a maladjusted individual from very early on, and you people, little by slowly, are readjusting me. My father was a role model of mine. My sponsors have been role models of mine. But I really, when I was, growing up in New York, I wasn't really looking to find a role model so that 30 years later I could tell you, how great these people were in my life. Because I hurt a lot of people before I got here. And I almost never made it here. So if you're here, please treasure the seat you're in. When Richard talks about Fred Cohen, God rest his soul, and I come here, and as I was driving here, I was flashing on how many, God rest their souls, people have come across our paths in the few short years since I've been sober. And it's a killer disease. So anyway, my experience back then is the first time I drank probably summed up what could have saved a lot of pain, but it wasn't the way it was supposed to be. I was about 14 or 15 years old, and we had phony proof in Queens, New York City. And a bunch of my, I don't know what you call them, associates or but I don't know, what do you call like teenagers that are self-destructing together? But whatever they were, was it? Gang. Well, we weren't a gang, we're Jewish. But it was something, like, So anyway, so they dared me that if I would drink all the booze that they would order me. We used to go to this club in Long Island called the Pied Piper. It was in Glen Cove off of exit 39. And that if we went out there and I would drink all the booze they ordered me, that they would pay for it. So there were two things there that struck my attention. Number one, the fact that they were going to pay for it. Number two, that they dared me to do something. And that word dare, unfortunately, carried a long way. I mean, even into my sobriety. Because if you're daring me to do something, you're testing my manhood and my... The whole bit, so like, no matter what it was, if you dared me, I was going to do it. So I simply said, let's go. So we drove out to the Pied Piper, and we sat there, and I'm looking around the room. I don't think anybody was there that night. Although if you were, then I'm going to tell the truth, because I sat at this bar and they started ordering me a shot of gin, a shot of scotch, a shot of tequila, you know, just like back to back to back. Now, I would love to stand there and tell you that I stood there. They couldn't believe, you know, that I was just drinking and drinking, and the Pied Piper ran out of booze, and they had to call the neighboring pub. You can't believe what they got here. And they sent over more booze. That's not what happened. Probably after a very few amount of that psychosis, I passed out. And these guys, my associates or my gang, they picked me up, and they put me in the bushes right outside the Pied Piper. Please keep in mind, this is the first time I drank. It's an integral part of this story. And they went back in and had fun and partied and danced, and we're probably talking about this jerk that's laying in the bushes, you know, that it cost them a few dollars to get me in the bushes. And the night was over, 1 or 2 in the morning. By now I'm in the bushes, and I'm covered in my own puke. They put me in the back of the car, they drove me home, they rang my mom's doorbell, and they left me in the hallway there. In this garden apartment we lived in. My mom came to the door, she picked me up, oh my God, you know, whatever she said, what mothers say when their kids, you know, in a fetal position covered in puke. And she went, and she put me to bed. The next morning, I woke up with a full-blown case of poison ivy, head to toe. Now, twenty-something years later, they give me this silly book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Very early on in this book, it says the following. It will appear that we have an allergy to alcohol. In the early 60s, Helen Keller could have told I had an allergy to alcohol. I drank, I passed out, I threw up, and I broke out head to toe the first time I drank. That is not the end of my drinking story. That was the first time. Because it's a progressive disease, everything gets worse. If you've got this disease, and you go out and pick up a drink or a drug, it's going to get worse. That's a guarantee. Nothing that I wrote, or it's just the way it is. Once this thing is rolling along and you stop it for a little while and then pick up again, I don't understand how that works, but I'm going to tell you it progresses. And the reason I know that is because I've watched so many people come in and get some time put together and then go out to pick up a chemical. And then we're at their funeral. See, this is not a kidding around thing. I mean, we're here, we're going to laugh a little bit, we'll cry a little bit, but we're blessed. If you have a seat here in Alcoholics Anonymous, hold on. Hold on, man. Treasure it. And I thank so much. I thank God for the sponsorship I've had since I got here, which we'll get into in a bit, because without that, I'd be dead meat. You know, like my friend Paula says, if I didn't have someone to bounce my insanity off of, not only 27 years, I'm talking about today. I cannot do this alone. Hey, Pete. Wow, there's one of my sobriety brothers. Good to see you, Peter. We got sober together. And so it's in the 60s, and you know, that was right in the whole, drug thing. And And alcohol is a drug. And I'm not going to get into talking about drugs. I'm going to talk about what happened to me, you know, because I used to like to say, but I'm not controversial anymore, that, you know, the only people that don't like you talking about drugs at an AA meeting are the ones still taking them. But I'm not going to say that anymore. I've outgrown my controversial nature. Not. Anyway, so what happened is this thing began progressing and I started getting in trouble. And I started getting in more trouble. And what happened is I was 16 and we would hang out on National Boulevard in Long Beach, Long Island. And we would go and we would drink and taking these barbiturates and just, you know, you get a great tan when you can't move, you know. And then a friend would turn you over, you know, and so you, where you could drown in like 3 inches of water. So one day the neighbors in the apartment buildings outside, they must have, you know, been upset with what we were doing to their neighborhood. So they backed up these two paddy wagons onto National Boulevard, and we got arrested. And I actually, this shows a little bit of my problem today, is that I sort of was proud of that arrest. Because it was in the newspapers. And I liked the way they wrote about me. It's very important to me what you think of me. And the fact that 30 years later I could tell you what the article said shows another one of my problems. But I'm going to tell you anyway. The first paragraph of this article says, 20 well-tanned youths from the Upper East Side discotheque crowd were arrested today on National Boulevard for public intoxication. I thought that was so cool. I mean, as a matter of fact, for years, I would carry that article in my wallet. And I'd be, you know, before I really went down the tubes, you know, I was like one of those, you know, the clubbing guys on 2nd Avenue and 3rd Avenue, you know, picking up babes and Rolling Stone and Framis and the Golden 20s. But I'd be too shit-faced to talk to these honeys. But I would have my wallet and I'd have my article. And so I see some babe that I really have designs on, but I can't talk to her. I mean, I didn't have no rap. I couldn't talk. So I would take the article out of my wallet. I think that's where I met my first wife. No kidding. The only reason I even tell you that story is obviously it wasn't a serious arrest. It was a $50 fine, and it was, you know, no big deal. But the reason that arrest, the longer I'm sober, has become that much more important to me, is that was July 4th, 1964. July 4th, 1965, 1 year later, I was arrested on the same beach for the same charge. The only difference was there weren't 20 of us then. There were only two of us. And the other person arrested with me was Karen Schaefer, God rest her soul. She died in 1967, the first heroin overdose in my neighborhood. See, the other 18 people, just because they were arrested, so what? I mean, they had a bad day. Some of them are vice presidents of major corporations today. They had a bad day, they got a little whacked, they said, oh no, I can't do that, my career, my life, my family. They turned around and they went, you know, back to do whatever you're supposed to do. Karen and I didn't have that choice because we had the disease of alcoholism and addiction. Karen, God rest her soul, never got to a meeting. So anything I say to you is all said with the realization that some power, that's why I love the way Armin opened that meeting, with the whole St. Francis thing and saying the prayer and going within. Because I often think, you know, if talk of God is going to scare you out of these rooms, then booze and drugs is going to scare you right back in. Okay? And this is coming from someone. When I got here, I didn't know if I was an agnostic or an atheist. And I found out I was an ignoramus. You know, I was watching. I have to watch Maurice because when Maurice comes to hear me speak, he tells everyone next to him what I'm going to say next. So I just had to give him the look. Anyway, you know, from the mid-60s straight through for the next 15 years, my life just kept going lower and lower And when I thought it couldn't go any lower, it went lower yet. You know, there was an old line in a Bob Dylan song, "What's a sweetheart like you doing in a place like this?" And I have to tell you something. I kept ending up in those places. I don't know how it happened. But all my morals, all the things I was brought up with, everything that mattered to me, the family, the love, the things that I was supposed to be, the things I was going to go, the places I was going to go, the things I was going to do, this thing called life, and I sacrificed it and threw it all out the window because nothing mattered anymore. You didn't matter. My wives didn't matter. My kids didn't matter. My parents didn't matter. My jobs didn't matter. Nothing mattered. If you got close to me, you were going to end up the worse for wear. Because I totally ran through the lives of everybody that was close to me. Because they're the easiest targets. And that's what we do about damaging those around us. And thank God today, by the grace of God, I've been able to make amends to everybody in my life. And the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is to try not to create any new ones. And, you know, we all are imperfect in that too. And just don't leave here, no matter what. You know, you get here, you stay here, you treasure being here. Find somebody else that's really whacked. And it makes you feel good. I mean, I got a table over here, man. I saw each one of these guys real early on, and so how could I have any problems today? I know where they were. You know, so anyway, in the 60s, it was just more of the same and worse, okay? I got addicted to narcotics, and I moved into the city, and I moved into Harlem, and I moved into the Lower East Side, and my life kept getting worse, and I started getting arrested, and then the arrest got more serious because it's a progressive disease, okay? And then in 1969, I wanted to stop. I was finished. You know, okay, call it a day. I'm done. I quit. I didn't use the word surrender, but I quit. Show me how. And nobody showed me how. So they sent me to these drug treatment programs, Daytop Village, where you were able to earn drinking privileges, you know. And I don't condemn them. No, I don't condemn them. They did the best they could back then. They weren't doing that so they could kill me or create alcoholics. Just like when I was on a methadone program, that they didn't, it was great. They were doing the best they could at that time. You know, we all learn, and that's why I try not to keep a closed mind about anything. I try to keep an open mind, and that's because of Ray Allen and Fred T, two people that really, really were there for me. You know, in the 70s, I was in New York, and my life was getting worse. The social, public intoxication arrests were now turning into felony arrests. And then felony arrests with a little more severity, where I was facing prison time, a lot of time in prison. Matter of fact, somebody said to me before the meeting early on, said, "Wow, I hope you're not nervous." I said, "I'm going to tell you what nervous is." Nervous is standing in Newport, Rhode Island in 1969, facing 15 years in prison, with the judge telling you from the podium, asking you if anybody made you any promises that this sentence is not going to be 50. Now, my dad may rest in peace, had worked the deal out with the lawyer that, you know, I was going to go wherever. But now this guy's saying in public court, there's no promises and you're ready to be sentenced right now. And I'll tell you what, if you want to talk about your stomach tightening up, you want to talk about you saying to yourself at that minute, "Oh my God, what if this guy's serious? What if he didn't get the message? What if he had a fight with his old lady that morning? What if I'm really going to prison for 15 years now?" 1969. So, man, I'll tell you what. You know, each of us has our own story to get us here. And the longer I'm sober, the more I realize each of us has an incredible story to be allowed to stay here. Because that's what, it's a thing called life. You know, my mom, as she rest in peace, always used to have this great saying. She used to say, "Man plans and God laughs." Okay? And she used to say it in Yiddish. I'll give you a little Yiddish here just for you people. It used to be, "Man plocked and God locked." So now you could just share that with your friends, you know, like Sean. And that's the story of life. You know, when we get here, they tell us God draws straight lines with crooked sticks. Well, there's a couple of hundred crooked sticks sitting right here this morning. Every one of us is a crooked stick that was divinely touched by another crooked stick and managed to get here to have this seat so we could find the next crooked stick. That's what we're about, man. We're the people that rescued the degenerates from Earth, the people from the dung heap of life, the refuse pile. The people that have no future, those are the ones we excel in. The people that have been down every road, burnt every bridge, and we come here and we're blessed. 1976 is probably it's a key date in my life. Because I would certainly much rather talk about where I've been since I've been here than what happened to me before. I got in a lot of trouble, okay? And I got in trouble with the jails, and then the overdoses, and then the suicides, because this happy-go-lucky kid all of a sudden wanted to die every day. I don't know how that happened. I don't know how it happened, but it did happen. And so, you know, the whole thing just kept going down and down. So anyway, 1976, I'm now what's known as a functional alcoholic. I have a good job. I'm a national sales manager of a home improvement company in New York City. And I'm drinking, and I'm on methadone, and I'm just doing my job. You know, I mean, I walked in, you know, my attaché case and my suit. And I was very productive. Now, because I told you earlier, it was very important to me about what you thought of me. My family had a very bad impression of me. I'm talking about my whole family. Because all I'd done is everybody in my family, did you hear what happened to Paul? You know, my cousins in Maryland, did you hear what Paul did last night? Do you believe he went through the windshield of a car on the Long Island Expressway and left the car there? All of these things, this is what was going through the family. So I had a plan. I was married at this time to that girl. You know, I don't know what she was thinking. I don't know what any of my wives were thinking, honest to God. You know, they have Alan on, and you say, you know, oh, well, you know. Let me tell you something. Anybody that suited up and showed up with me, they did it without blinders on. They saw what they were getting, okay? And, Don, you keep living. Your wife's got problems, too. but, you know, So I have this plan, and I say, you know, I'm going to invite my cousins from Baltimore, Maryland, to come up to see a Broadway show. Now, I had this whole game plan set. There was this great show, top show with Anthony Perkins at the time, God rest his soul. And one day I would have gotten to make amends to him, but I never did. Well, anyway, let me not get ahead of myself. So I set this plan in motion with my wife, Sharon. I go to a ticket broker. I get the best seats available for this Saturday night, February 1st, 1976, this show on the 45th Street Helen Hayes Theater on Broadway. And my game plan is they're going to drive up from Maryland. I'm going to take them to this beautiful show. I'll take them to a nice steak dinner first, this place in Manhattan called Rossoff's. And we'll go to this show. I got second row center seats on a Saturday night. And by the time the show is over, they'll go back to Maryland and they'll say to my Uncle Mush and my Aunt Rita and my cousins, you're not going to believe how great Paul is doing. It's unbelievable. He's living in this beautiful apartment. He's got his great wife. My daughter was 2 years old. It's unreal. I mean, amazing, really, what has happened to cousin Paul. Let me share with you why it didn't quite happen that way. Let me replay to you February 1st, 1976. It started out exactly as I planned. I had the tickets. We had the reservation at Rossoff's Steakhouse. My cousin Mark and his wife Arlene arrived at our apartment in plenty of time. We went and we got in my luxury Lincoln Continental and I drove them down to 45th Street and we parked the car and we go in and we have this sumptuous steak dinner right there. You know, money was no object. Because this was important for me, so the family would know how great Paulie was doing. The family really didn't get that impression after what I'm about to share with you. Here's what did happen. We go from dinner to the theater. Now, I'm sure a lot of you have been to Broadway, or if not, you've seen it on TV. Big theater. We're in the second row on a Saturday night in a packed house of this top show with this guy, Anthony Perkins. The name of the show was called Equus. Now, I don't know if anyone's seen it or if you did see it, if you understood it, but the fact of the matter is we were there and it was a very confusing play. Here's what I remember from the play. Then I'm going to share with you what was told to me after the play. We're sitting there, and it's this guy, he's a psychiatrist, and there's a horse on the stage, and he's got a pipe, and he's got these little horn-rimmed glasses, and he's talking to the audience. You know, that's his lines. I mean, he's an actor. He's doing his monologue. And at a very, I mean, it was a very quiet, somber, confusing play. But at this one particular point of the play, he asked a question as part of his monologue that they did in rehearsal many, many times, I'm sure. I told you I came from a very good family. My parents told me if someone asks a question, you answer it. Here's what happened from that moment for the next very long period of time. Anthony Perkins sitting there, Helen Hayes Theater, February 1st, 1976, and he asked the audience a question. The other 2,000 or however many people in the theater knew it what was known as a rhetorical question. I didn't. I stood up. Second row. Helen Hayes Theater. February 1st, 1976. And I pointed to Tony. And I said, "That's because my name is Paul Efron." Let me share with you what happened from this point forward. Most of this is from the sharing of my wife at the time and my cousins to me. I'm standing up. My wife Sharon and my cousin Mark look behind me. What just happened? They came to the show with me. We had dinner. They know I'm not in the show. Tony Boy dropped his pipe when I said that. However, I need to tell you at this day, I believe that 50% of the people in that theater thought I was in the show. Nobody knew what it was about. The guy's talking to a horse. He's talking to people about it. Mark, Arlene, and Sharon knew I wasn't in the show. So they pulled me down and sat me down. 15 minutes later, I got up again. And the management also knew I wasn't in the show, so they asked us to leave the theater. That night, I woke up in, I guess you could call it, a mental hospital. Today they call them treatment centers. An asylum, a place where they don't want you out there. You know, and people come in, they have problems with the second step, about insanity, I'm not insane. Let me tell you something, if you came out of a treatment center, it's because they were going to tell you what to do for 28 days, when to get up, where to go, how to do it, why to do it, because you're not safely allowed out there with humanity. So if you have a problem with the second step, that you don't think you're insane, take a look at your life. The fact of the matter is we get here, and we can only get healed by admitting there's something not working properly up here. I know that my ticker needs fixing. I know that, and that's why I keep coming here. So anyway, so I end up in this, I ended up in a bunch of them from that day forward. My friend Gasper likes to call houses for the very, very nervous. And what happened is I kept getting more nervous. I went to this this really nice mental hospital, and a lot of people from New York know it. It was called Hillside General Hospital. I mean, it was beautiful. They would advertise in the New York Times in the magazine section, "Come and let your families stroll our luscious grounds while they watch you make your leather belts." And I got very good at that. What happened, you know, I also need to preface this by telling you, I never graduated anything in my entire life. I got thrown out of high school. I got thrown out of Hebrew school. Anything that had a graduation date attached to it, I managed to sabotage it sometime before. That's the great news about Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't fail for lack of graduation. There is no graduation. You just keep coming, keep coming, and that's the great thing. They said that to me in my first meeting. They said, you're going to be coming for a very long time. And I said, why is that? They said, only the sick ones keep coming to meetings. So the fact that Jim's here 49 years later, we know what that means. You just keep showing up, because little by slowly we get better. Anyway, so I went to this mental hospital, and they diagnosed me as a paranoid schizophrenic. That's great. It really isn't that bad. At least I was something. My whole life I was nothing, and now I'm something. So I left Hillside. I went to Elmhurst and North Shore Hospital. And every time, and back then insurance covered for 90 days instead of 30 days. So you would stay for 90 days, and then you were cured. And they'd give me a whole bunch of pills, and I'd take all the pills, and I'd overdose, and then they'd send me somewhere else. So what happened is, finally, after doing this for three or four mental hospitals, from that February 1st date, I committed a real serious overdose, and I came out of it, and the guy looked at me in the emergency room, and he said, we could either send you here, but you know what? You're going to what we call in New York, it's like the big house. It's this place on the Northern State Parkway. It's a big, imposing red building. And it's called Creedmoor State Hospital. That was my last residence in New York. Okay, so the fact that I'm standing here is a miracle. The fact that you're sitting here listening to this mental patient, put that into your own inventory. And think about it. That you got up at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning to come here, some state mental patient, talk to you after breakfast. So just realize, like, that really where you're at. Let's put that right where it belongs, okay? And so I played that thing out, and I was in Creedmoor. And actually, the only thing I've ever graduated to this point in time was somewhere in between Hillside General Hospital and Long Island Jewish, which was the hospital after Creedmoor. Somewhere in there, I graduated something. I went from being a paranoid schizophrenic to being a manic depressive. Boy, did I feel of worth. They just changed my medicines, and boy, I was back on life. I had been in these hospitals for a year. But here was the sad thing. I got out of there after 1 year. 3 months later, I was on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, drinking and drugging and killing myself again. You can't scare us. I'm not looking to scare you. If you're here, treasure being here. Please, don't leave. None of the people I ran with got here except one. Many of the people I got sober with have left here, and they're not here anymore. This is a killer disease. The last time I was arrested in New York, by the grace of God, was Halloween 1978. We were running out of Harlem, and it was Halloween weekend, and my partner, Arthur Parks, God rest his soul, we got pulled over, and they put us in the Tombs for the weekend. And my wife and my daughter at that time had to spend Halloween weekend. My daughter was 4. They had to spend Halloween weekend in the Tombs with every dreg of society waiting to bond daddy out. You think we don't harm people? Our kids, our wives, our families? I was able to make amends for that later in sobriety, because I have a beautiful son who's 21. And when he was 5 or 6, we flew up to New York, and my daughter and the 3 of us went trick-or-treating. I was able to replace something I stole from her. That's what amends means, to make right, to repair, to reinstate. And so I came out of there, and then finally in 1979, my wife Sharon affectionately referred to as number one, she had enough. You know, she just hit the limit. At every point in time, somebody who's with you, no matter how much they're with you, they're going to say enough's enough. She had enough. Five or six arrests, five or six mental hospitals, the overdoses, the comas, the whole nine yards. And she said, get out. I was thinking about this today, too, because I have a beautiful wife today. I mean, we're married 14 years, and she's the greatest woman on the planet. But I had two others, and I was thinking about that. They were great, too, you know, at the time. But I was thinking about most people, like when they get divorced, they're like big, you know, things, you know, with attorneys and have my attorney contact your attorney. And what happens to me with my divorces is one day I come home and they look at me and they say, you're out of here. No discussion. Get out. Leave. And that's been the way those other two went, because not a question of divvying things up. Please leave. Take anything you want. Just get out of my life. Because, you know, I could be like that. I have a beautiful wife today. Anyway, 1979, I moved down to Florida. By this time, I'm on Social Security disability insurance because the United States government, Ronald Reagan, God rest his soul, were giving me a lot of money to not work, which was cool. I mean, really, because I'd been productive and they prorated about if you made this much when you were 20, what you're going to make when you're 40. And I mean, I was getting a lot of money to not participate in life. And I'm in Florida 6 months, and this is where my life changed, where it happened, and all of the rest doesn't really matter. Because it's February and it's 1980, and I'm just bouncing around the streets down here. I'm drinking, I'm drugging, I got my disability checks in the mail on the third of every month. I just go to the mailbox and it's there. One day, I bought a copy of the Miami Herald. Now, I don't know why. I lived in Fort Lauderdale. I mean, today I do know why, but I'm just going to show you the power of the power. I bought a copy of the Miami Herald. Now, I wasn't like checking on my investments. I wasn't checking some travel plans that I was taking to the south of France. For some reason, I bought this Miami Herald. The front page of one of the sections had the word narcotics in it. Got my attention. I cut the article out, and it was about two people who were just starting a program, about a program that just started in Broward County, borrowed from Alcoholics Anonymous, called Narcotics Anonymous. And they were sober and clean and blah, blah, blah. So I cut the article out, and I made the phone call to this guy, Curtis. And he came and he picked me up and took me to a meeting. And I sat there in the meeting, and it was six people, seven people, eight people in the meeting. And it was this guy talking. Let me tell you something. I was so abusive to this guy, Curtis, on the way. You know, he's sober three and a half years. And he came and picked me up, as an active 12-step member does. And I'm in his car, and he's telling me about the perils of getting sober in Broward County Jail. And he's this little guy with red hair and muscles. And I tell him what we would do to someone like him in New York. I really start abusing him. I mean, I abused him so badly that he refused to take me home. And he was an active participant of the program. 2 days later, something happened in that meeting. I don't know what to this very day. So if you leave here tonight and you go get shit-faced, it's okay. God willing, you get back before you don't get back. 2 days later, something clicked. I had one phone number. It was this guy, Curtis. I make the phone call. He comes back. He gets me again. He must have forgotten from Sunday to Tuesday. And he comes back and he picks me up. And we go to this place. They read the St. Francis prayer here this morning. And we went to this place in downtown Fort Lauderdale called St. Francis Mission. It was a little one-room storefront right next to the courthouse. And I walk in there, and I don't know if anyone's ever had this feeling, but I walked in and I said to myself, what am I doing here? Why am I here? Why did I even call this guy back? What am I wasting his time and my time? And you know what? I got up to leave. Because I wasn't at a bottom at this point in my life. This was 1980. My bottom was 1969. I wasn't really in that much trouble here. I had some money. I had the government supporting me. There weren't that many people looking for me. I was down here in South Florida. I wasn't addicted to any particular drugs at the time. I had enough money to drink and drug on a monthly basis till the third of next month. Why was I here? So I went up to him and I got ready to leave. This is where, I don't care if you didn't listen to anything else to this point in time, this is where it began. And today I just continue to want to let it continue. But on February 12th, 1980, at or about 8:27 p.m., in the New Freedom Group, in the St. Francis Mission on Southeast 6th Street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, I got up to leave. And I went to Curtis, and I said, Curtis, you know what? I'm sorry to have bothered you. Thanks for picking me up again. And if I ever need you, I'll give you a call. And I was leaving the meeting. Now, if you want to talk about a power of a power, this 11th step, the power and everything we're talking about, and how powerful this power can be, at that exact minute, I'm walking out the door onto 6th Street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I had some cash. I was going to go get whacked downtown and do whatever I did, whatever you do, which is nothing, and you go home and you do it again. At that exact minute, in walked a guy from my block in Queens, New York City, into this little storefront on 6th Street in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So this guy, Mark, walks in. We look at each other. It wasn't like, wow, Mark, I'm so glad to see you. Look, well, I didn't give a shit if he looked. Well, he thought he was dead. He thought I was dead. But somehow, the fact is he's here and I'm here. He said something. None of us know. Neither of us know what today. I ended up back in that meeting. And I sat down on one of these couches, and I looked up to the front of the room. And in the front of the room, Mark was sitting at that table. Now, Mark had been asked to speak at that meeting 3 weeks before that night. So, see, the way I look at it, and you don't have to look at it this way, I look at it that this power that I choose to call God said, you know what, Paul? You're done. I mean, really, you're toast. You're an inch away from just being written off at 25, 30, 31, because there's really no point in you. You're a dreg of society. You're a taker. You bleed everybody near you. But maybe if I make it so apparent to you about the possibility, and I believe that today, that that's what happened, that God in his infinite wisdom, which I hope to God that he's still happy with that decision, that he said, you know what? No, because, you know, I mean, I do this cool thing. I once read this thing, you know, that if you're always helping somebody, then God's not going to need you. So if I'm helping somebody and I always have someone in the back of my mind that I want to try to help, well, God takes a look at, like, who's checking out this year? And he says, hey, this guy's too busy. I'm going to leave him there for. Because, you know, there may be a great thing after we leave here, but nobody ever came back and told me yet, so I don't know. So I want to stay here for a while. I love the deal here. I'm not ready to check out. And so anyway, Mark tells his story that night. I didn't have to listen to his story. It was the same exact story as mine. It was just as bad, just as traumatic, just as despicable, just as many people hurt. As a matter of fact, Mark's newspaper article was much better than mine because his was in a little bit after mine, like 64 or 65, and it was on the front page of the Daily News. Because they did this whole sweep of our neighborhood of all of the people selling reefer when we were in high school. And they went to Mark's parents' house, and the picture on the front page of the Daily News was Mark Friedman being brought from his parents' house in curlers. Now, think about how he had to go through the rest of his life. Being brought out of his parents' house at 3 a.m. with curlers in his hair. Because that's what they used to do in the 60s. Right, Stan? You remember that, right? No more curlers. Not happening, right? So anyway, so Mark told his story. I didn't have to listen to it. I'm going to tell you when I started paying attention. He sat in the front of that room, and he said, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a drug for 6 months. You know what? That's almost believable. You know, if somebody got up and said I had 5 years or 8 years, I'm sure I would have been out long ago. But when he stood there and, or sat there and said, I haven't had it necessary to take a drink or a drug for 6 months, I said, you know, maybe that's doable. Because Mark, just like me, couldn't go 6 weeks without a drink or a drug. Couldn't go 6 days without a drink or a drug. The only time I refused a drink or a drug is if I misunderstood the question. I was the guy, give me more. What do you got? Bring it on, you know. When I'm unconscious, I'm okay. Until then, I'm not ready to stop. So I picked up that silly little white chip that night. I don't know to this day how it works, why it works, but I'm gonna tell you, for me, it worked. It said, if you're sick and tired of being sick and tired and you want to try our way of life, we offer you this white chip. And then they used to tell these stupid things, put it under your tongue if it melts, you got put it on your head, hammer it, throw it in the gutter. I don't know what any of that crap meant, but I'm telling you what, I treasured this little white chip. It says, you know what, just look at it. And if you want to pick up, just think of someone you met there and call them. And the next day, Mark and Joe, who was my first sponsor, took me to the 101 Club in Pompano. Because you see, there was one NA meeting in all of Broward County. So if I was gonna go to 90 meetings in 90 days, it would take me 4 years. And plus, I wasn't working, so what greater thing to do than go to AA and start meetings? And so it was like built in for me, I mean, right in my job description. So we get to the 101 Club. I need to share with you what I looked like on February 13th, 1980, the day I get to the 101. I'm wearing a three-piece blue, powder blue suit. I have one of these collared pimp shirts, you know, with the Huggy Bear shirts, you know, way down here. I got my pimp hat. I'm 145 pounds. I'm a size 31 waist. Nice, right, Susie? I've grown, haven't I now? And I have an attaché case. And I come walking up to the side door of the 101 Club. And this guy, Jim Sullivan, who's still a real good friend of mine today, lives in Jacksonville. He meets me at the door. And he says, whoa. We could see you have the answers. Tell by your walk, by your talk, just by the way you look, everything about you, you've got the answers. But do us a favor. Leave your brains right here when you come in, because this thing's working real well for 40, 50 years. It's worked before you got here. It's going to work long after you leave here. So just come down and get stupid. Take the letter Y out of your vocabulary. Let us love you back to life. And, you know, I thank God today. I mean, I was very whacked when I got here. I got to promise you. You know, I mean, immediately, that obsession to drink and drug was removed. I didn't pray for it. I didn't ask for it. It was such a miraculous thing that occurred from that night before. Only once since that day have I even thought of getting loaded. It's almost 27 years ago. What happened from this point forward is I began going to as many meetings as I possibly could in Miami and Palm Beach, because I was like a paid member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was very cool. As long as I got to that mailbox on the third of the month, I could do anything else during the month. So I would get changed for meetings, I'd shower and shave. I mean, I looked good. What happened is, after I was sober a little bit of time, you know, obviously, if you're single in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and now you're finished, like, getting whacked 24 hours a day, you start noticing women, and it's about time that, you know, we figure out how to handle that. So I met this honey, God rest her soul, but she died sober. And we decided that we were a match. We each had 90 days. And so we moved into her boyfriend's apartment because he was out on a drug run. So she said we could stay there for a while. Well, here's what happened after a very short period of time. My sponsor, Joe, called me up one Sunday morning. And he says, Paul, could you do me a favor? I said, what's that? He says, would you please come up to my apartment? I just want to talk to you. Sure, absolutely, Joe. And I had 3 months. And it's like a privilege that my sponsor's calling me. I go up to the 101 Club, and I knock on his door, and I say, what's up? He says, come on outside for a minute. And we go outside, and Joe was in the air conditioning repair business at the time. And he went into his truck, and he reached under the seat of his truck, and he pulled out a .357 Magnum, and he put it to my head. And he said, if you're not out of that effing house by the morning, I'm going to blow your brains out. And he put the gun back under the seat. Now, I have to tell you something. I've read this book. I've read it over and over and over. Nowhere in this book does it say sponsor pulls peace on pigeon. But I'm going to tell you what. Thank God fear took over and I moved out. You know, what's going to happen is if you go to enough meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and usually you see the people that are smiling and laughing, and in the middle, there's going to be talk of God. And because I told you that wasn't part of my vocabulary, I realized I better at least try to investigate it. So I had about, right after I moved out, I don't know where I was living now, but I moved and I went to the Sunrise Boulevard flea market with my friend Maureen. And it was late in the day on a Sunday, and they were packing their things up, ready to go. And we're walking through the aisles, and there was this guy selling statues. You know, just like statues, you know, like with a armor, knights in armor, with a guy with the thing. You know, I don't even have it, but you know what I mean. You get the picture. You understand? I'm not good at description. Matter of fact, I fail Pictionary. When we play Pictionary, I just go. My kids think I'm, like, retarded. I just keep going like this. Anyway, so we're at this flea market, and I said, how much you want for that statue? He says, $70. I said, I'll give you $10. He says, $70. I'll give you $10. $60. I'll give you $10. Anyway, I bought my first higher power at the Sunrise Boulevard flea market for $15. Because you people had told me, if you ask for help in the morning and you thank the power at night, you'll be okay. So what happened, I had this now this little one-room apartment off of Fifth Avenue, the closest I've ever gotten. Fifth Avenue in Cracktown on Sunrise Boulevard. That's where I lived, by the McDonald's. A one-bedroom apartment, one-room apartment. And I had my statue. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd go outside, and I'd smack the God, keep me clean and sober today. And I'd go to my 3, 4, 5 meetings throughout the day. I'd come back at night, I'd smack him up the other side of the head. God, thanks for another beautiful day. You know what? It worked till it didn't work anymore. Matter of fact, I once told that story, and Ray Allen was there, and he said, and I was in some pain at the time, and he looked at me and he says, Paul, that's just God smacking you back now. But you know what? My God doesn't smack me back. He wants me to enjoy this deal. Come on, we've been to hell already. We don't have to go there again. You know, you'll have bits and pieces of, like, uncomfortable times, but he wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. That's what this thing's about. So then I was 6 months sober. And my dad, and this is why I think a lot of the reason I try to live my life to the fullest today, because like I told you, my mom said, man plans and God laughs. Well, my dad, may he rest in peace, was the hardest working guy in the world. He drove a New York City taxi cab, and there's nothing he wouldn't do for me, and he worked around the clock, and my mom worked, and their goal was that when he was 65, they were gonna sell the cab, she would get her school retirement, and they were gonna buy an RV because they loved each other and drive around the country just to see the beautiful country we have. And that's an incredible plan. What a great concept. But you see, that isn't the way it played out. I got sober in February 1980, my father got diagnosed with multiple myeloma 2 months prior to that. So instead of these plans of selling the cab and driving, he was sick from his birthday, his 65th birthday in November of 79, straight on through. Now I get sober, and I'm flying up and back to New York. And we were like this, man. We were tight. And he sees it, but he can't enjoy it. You know how many times during my life today when I'm traveling or I'm anywhere, and I say, Dad, man, see, it is cool. And I know he sees it. I know he's here right now. But I haven't had the chance to experience it with him. Because here's what happened. The week before he died, I flew up to New York, and he was now getting real sick like cancer does to us, you know, and it just emaciated. And we're standing in his bedroom, and I look at him, and I said, Dad, and I tell him I have 6 months sober now. And I know 6 months of what you people taught me. And I'm telling him that. I say, Dad, easy does it. He looks at me. Talk a little bit more, and we're standing up by his dresser, and I said, Dad, this too shall pass. Well, those are the only two things I knew, but this last one didn't quite go over with him. And he looked at me, standing in his bedroom, and he banged his fist on the dresser, and he said, Paul, I'm dying. I lived a good life. Are you still going to your meetings? At 6 months, he saw something that you people were doing to me, that no drug treatment center, no psychiatrist, no psychologist, no mental hospital, that nothing was able to do what was happening in 6 months of hanging around with you people. So if you tell me that there isn't something like that shows when we get it, he saw it. The next week, the only time I wanted to get loaded since I'm sober, I was back here, and it's August 29th, 1980. I have 6 months, a little over 6 months. And I was fighting with somebody about something, I don't know why, and I just wanted to say, screw it, I'm gonna go get loaded. And it was the summertime, and it was still light out, and for me to do what I had to do, it needed to be dark. But I remembered something, that my home group, the Express Group, had a beginner's meeting that met over at the airport by the old the youth center house. So I figured I'll go to the airport till it gets dark. And then I'll go and I'll get whacked and like that. So I drive to the airport. Keep in mind, I'm gonna go and check out of Alcoholics Anonymous right now. I drive to the meeting. I walk in the meeting, I listen to the beginner's meeting, and then I'm leaving. And as I'm walking out, as it's getting dark, and I'm walking out to go and kill myself in one way or another. I mean, you know, if you get loaded, it's just slow suicide or fast suicide, but obviously I'm gonna die. And at that moment, the following happened. The person that was supposed to chair the meeting didn't show up. They asked Curtis to chair the meeting. I'm walking out and Curtis says to me, would you be my speaker? So now I'm in a quandary. I'm going to get whacked on the one hand, but you people told me you never say no to an AA request on the other hand. I ended up speaking that night. In the middle of speaking, I don't know what I said. It wasn't anything true. I didn't tell my drunkalogue. I didn't tell any. I talked about this God that I didn't even believe in. I threw this whole Godalogue out there. But in the middle of that talk, the desire to get loaded left. I went home that night, and I got in my shower, and I was praying. You know, that's where I was praying. For after my statue days, my next 3 to 6 months, my prayers were in the shower with my hands against the wall, like I was being frisked. You know, it was a comfortable position, the shower coming down, and I would talk to God, I would sing to God, you know. And I simply said in the shower that night, I said, God, about my father, thy will be done. I didn't direct it. I didn't say, find a cure for cancer, please ease his pain, please my mom can't be alive. I didn't go through any of that. I simply said those four words, thy will be done. At 3 o'clock in the morning, my mom called, my dad had passed away. Now, I'm telling you, that wasn't a time for me to start doing backflips, wow, I found God. But I am gonna tell you, that was another notch for me knowing there's no mistakes here. this thing, any prayer sincerely and desperately asked is going to be heard by God. Okay? And God has a bunch of answers. He says yes. He says no. He says maybe. He says not now. And with me, sometimes he says, you got to be kidding. But, but you know, the key is that all my prayers are answered today because I don't pray for anything. I pray for knowledge of his will. I pray to be there, to be able to help somebody. Try to be a good example of what we have here. And I'm a pretty happy camper. I'm a pretty satisfied customer of Alcoholics Anonymous. So my dad died, and I come back to Florida, and that's when I ended up with my sponsor, who was my sponsor pretty much straight through, Fred T. God rest his soul. And you know what I forgot to do? But I know that Fred would want me to do it. Has anyone told you they loved you yet today? Well, I love you. That was the way Fred started every conversation. I mean, you're calling Fred about some real traumatic problem, and he said, has anyone told you they loved you yet today? You know, and it just kept saying it and saying it. You know what? Then eventually my wife would say, how come you never say that to me? Because Fred, every time he calls, said, so now you got to start doing it. Fred and I had an incredible relationship. Incredible. And Ray, who was Fred's sponsor, we had an incredible relationship. They tell you to call your sponsor. I didn't have a phone. So what I did on this Fifth Avenue apartment is I called Southern Bell. And I told them about how much traffic there was on this side street that I lived in Cracktown. And I needed not one but two payphones right outside my apartment, one for incoming and one for outgoing. There weren't many incoming calls. But what happened is I started calling Fred every day at 5:30. And I called him. I never missed. Then my life started getting better, and I moved to the Intercoastal, and I'm now sponsoring people. I have a pretty successful life. And I go up to Fred one day at the 101, and I say, Fred, I've called you every day for a year and a half. You haven't called me once. What's going on? And he didn't miss a beat. He looks at me. He says, you know what, Paul? As soon as you have something I want, I'll be sure to give you a call. And he turns around and walks away. You know, if you did that today, they'll report you to Intergroup or something. How could you treat your newcomer that way? I get treated just the way I needed to get treated. Fred and I developed a relationship that he was my love doctor. He carried me through marriages, divorces, birth of a child, death of a stepdaughter in her sleep, 15 years old. We can't say what the plan is going to be. We just have to be ready to accept whatever it is. You know, there's this thing that used to be said to me all the time, and it's so true. And I don't care if it's finance or romance or whatever's kicking your butt, if you're not in a good place today, just remember this one thing. When you're down to nothing, you're absolutely out of bullets. You're down to nothing. God is up to something. You see, that's the key, and that's what it takes here. It says we came to believe. We continue to come to believe every day. Obviously, when I walked in here today, and I see Louie, and I see Steve, and I see these guys here that I know for 25 years, my whole life, and I've watched the miracle in their lives. Now, how does that not reinforce helping me come to believe about what's possible here? I mean, is this guy Steve, did he leave? Oh my God, he's gonna pay a price, but I'm gonna tell the story anyway. Steve, who's sober 25, almost 26 years, I sponsored him in the early 80s. I mean, I still sponsor him today, maybe not until after this, since he left, but I sponsored him before he got here today. And we're ready to go through the steps. So I'm living in the Bay Colony Club off the Intercoastal. And I say, you come over to my house and we're gonna do the third step prayer. Now keep in mind, I was pretty thin back then, so I told him I was gonna leave the door open, I'd probably be in the shower, I'd come out, go wait in the bedroom. So he's in the bedroom, now I'm thin, you gotta picture this, I'm only one towel instead of two. And I come out of the shower, and I brush my hair, and Steve's on the bedroom, on the bed, and I look at him and I say, all right, Steve, on your knees. Well, he did it because obviously his willingness at that point was greater than his willingness today. But, you know, like Fred always said, the desperate becomes sweetly reasonable. If you're desperate for what you think is here, please let us hug you and love you and bring you back. Because that's what it is, to die from this disease. What a pity, what a tragedy, what a shame. What an unnecessary deal. I mean, I think about how many people I lost. About today's Breeders' Cup Day. I don't know if that means anything to anybody, but among the many things I did to excess, horses, gambling, women, track, all of that stuff. And today's like a big track day. And you know what? In sobriety, two of my closest friends that I love to gamble with, Billy Maron, God rest his soul, and Ricky Porter, God rest his soul, they're both dead. And they both died from this disease. I'm going to tell you about Billy real quickly, because Billy, I was at the Super Bowl in New Orleans 4 years ago, or whenever it was in New Orleans. And at halftime of the Super Bowl, I get a phone call on my cell phone that Billy Maron overdosed in Los Angeles. He had 17 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He picked up, went back and forth, could never get it again, and he died during my attendance at the Super Bowl. See, my life's gone from the toilet bowl to the Super Bowl, and his had gone there, and he chose to throw it back. Ricky Porter, God rest his soul. My closest guy in the world, he sat on my couch looking at me so many times. Started making some money, went to Thailand, other things became more important, came back, could never get it back. He had 5 years sober. Picked up, overdosed, died in Imperial Point Hospital. And I got 30 of those stories. Okay, so you know what? Because I can't tell you what's going to happen to me the next time I pick up, I just don't. No matter what, those three words, they were told to me the day I got here. Nothing has changed. No matter what, includes the following: death, divorce, bankruptcy, your business, losing your family. Whatever it is, falls into that category no matter what. Because sobriety is about life. You don't come in here, skip up the 12 golden steps of life and never experience golden steps of life and never experience a negative emotion. You come in here, experience life, and the test of sobriety is not picking up, no matter what. You know, they had this for the 12 steps. It's called the 10 Commandments. And the reason the 10 Commandments don't work for people like us, because they all start with thou shalt not. You tell me what I shalt not, and I'm shouting, babe. I'm going to shout all over town. But these things tells me what I shout. You shall come to believe. You shall come to love your fellow man. And it's such an incredible experience to know and believe that you can have it. And, you know, this peace beyond understanding that they talk about, we get pieces of that. I've had it. You know, I'm sure that I heard everything I needed to know in the first 90 days of my attendance here. And I'm spending the rest of my life, God willing, trying to perfect it, trying to incorporate it into my life. There's no perfection here. You know, I told you I have a beautiful wife today. Well, what happened is I married a woman I ran with in the 60s, in the 70s, and that didn't work. Then I married a woman who was sober, beautiful woman, great mother, each of them a mother of my children. So I ran out of civilians, and I married my cousin. Now, I'm not from Arkansas. She's a distant cousin. And so now, and she's light years ahead of me in every facet of life, and she looks at me, and I say to her sometimes, I say, Sandra, what were you thinking? I mean, we've been going out since 1990. She's a Barnard College graduate. She knows my whole story because she's part of my family. She was part of the family saying, wow, did you see what Paul did? So she must have just been having a bad day when that happened, but I'll tell you what, we have a glorious, glorious, glorious relationship. We respect each other. Mutual respect. It's not codependent. I don't know what that means. Interdependent. We rely on each other when we're together, and when not, we don't. You know, Ray always told me, I don't know where he got this information, it's so important in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God, I don't know how. I've stayed enthusiastic since the minute I got here. I jump out of bed in the morning. Every morning, 6 a.m. Because I did a survey. 95% of everyone who dies lying down. So I jumped up this morning, 6:05. I'm up. Let's go, pal. What do you got in store for today? He put another quarter in my expired parking meter. And he says, go out. Try to find someone you can impact positively today. And if you do that, I'm going to keep giving you the little candies. That's what it is. My God's like the candy dealer. You know, and sometimes the candies have sour potatoes in them, pieces in the middle. And you got to deal with it. It's not all like skipping through the tulips. But if you get a sponsor and you get that person you can share with, and you realize, you know, I used to think that Fred invented a problem shared is cut in half and a joy shared is doubled. He would always say that to me. Last week, I get something on the internet that says a problem shared is cut in half, a joy shared is doubled. William Shakespeare. I can't believe that. Fred told me he invented that. Then I'm at a meeting or something else in life, and they're saying about the second step, doing the same thing the same way and expecting different results. I thought that was invented by us, Albert Einstein. So just so you understand that none of this happened here. Happened here. We're just grasping like the people that did it before us because we need it a lot more than they do. And, you know, I'm going to close because, oh, I just wanted to say one thing because this is pretty important. You know, I started talking about, like, if you're single here and you're going to start going out with people, probably. And so you ask a woman out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what are you going to do? Well, I'll take you to a meeting. You know, so you take it. I got sober at the 101 Club, so all right, I'll take you to the 101 Club. So you go to the meeting, and you go, you have coffee at the meeting. You go out for a bite to eat after the meeting. And then you take her home. You don't know whether to kiss her goodnight or say the Lord's Prayer. But what happened, even more definitively, right along those same lines, because this is my favorite thing almost in the whole world. This big book, which if you don't have one, I really suggest you get one. And it was written many, many years ago, 1935. I don't know how this worked, but on page 69 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's all the talk about sex. Now, I don't know how that, but that's where it is, okay? I didn't invent that. Some woman in AA is having trouble with the men. You know, she's like really into the deal, you know, like, wow, you know. So she's going out with all of these guys, and she's really getting in a lot of pain. So she calls her sponsor. And her sponsor tells her to read page 69 of the big book, because that's where it tells about it. You know, it tells us how to deal with it, how to write about it, tells us all the instructions. But the girl, because she was so new, didn't remember what her sponsor said and thought her sponsor said to read page 96 of the big book. It's only two numbers interpolated. Let me tell you what page 96 said to this poor girl who was calling up her sponsor about help in the relationship and sexual area. Page 96, top of the page. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. I don't know where that chick ended up, but... You know, I got to share one other thing, or maybe two. I've had an interesting work career since I'm sober. I mean, it's been varied. I mean, I owned a transmission business, and I was a president of a brokerage firm, a stock brokerage firm. And I've done drug counseling, referring, and I've sold things that didn't exist over the telephone, and many things in between. In 2000, my wife and I were invited to Italy for a trip with her business, and we go on this incredible trip, and we're there going all through Italy, a two-week trip, and there's 30 couples there, and one guy I hook up with there of the 30 couples, and we get very close, and I don't know why, and somehow on the trip, I break my anonymity to them because they're getting whacked and they want to know why I'm not. And we come back to Florida. He calls me up and tells me to come. He'd like me to do some consulting for his firm. By the way, I found that out, that since I had my business, I became a consultant. And a consultant is really another term for unemployed. I've been a consultant for the last 8 years. I consult. You need consulting, come see me after the meeting. And so I go start to work there. I'm there for about 3 weeks. or a month, and he tells me, he says, come take a ride with me. And there was a guy working for Kenny named Perry who'd worked for him for 10 years. And we go to Perry's house, and I sit there, and I talk to him for about 2-3 hours. The next day, Perry ends up in treatment. Perry will be celebrating 6 years this coming February. We talk all the time. Now, if you don't think that this plan is so all-powerful, I'm in Italy on a trip with my wife. I meet this guy who 3 months later I'm working with in New Jersey, who takes me to meet a guy who's worked for him for 12 years. And this guy's now sober and active in Bergen County, New Jersey, in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. How does this happen? Because this power has all power. That's what we read. All power. Rarely have we seen a person fail. All power means all power. Not some, not a little bit, not once in a while. All. And the more I can give of my problems, situations, and life to him, the happier I am. And I'm just going to close with one thing that I've done for a long time because it works. And I'm a streak player. You know, if you're a gambler, you're a streak player. You know, if something's working, you want to keep it going. This has been working for a very long time, so I want to keep it going. I believe I play this game that God has this little helper, and his helper's name is Max. And every night, God checks in with Max, and he says, so Max, what's going on down there? And God, and Max says to God, I don't know, it just seems that 300, 400 million people that are talking to us, they're very upset with what they do for a living. The doctors want to be lawyers. The lawyers want to be accountants. They're just very, everybody's complaining to us. They're not happy with what they're doing for a living. God says, okay, and what else? He says, it seems to us, God, as we're listening up here, a billion and a half people are very upset with where they're living. The ones that are in New York want to be in California. The ones in America want to be in South America. The ones in Europe want to be. Nobody's happy with it. Everybody wants to be somebody else, somewhere else, and they're all complaining to us. And God says, what else is going on? He says, well, it seems virtually 50% of every single person that's talking to us is not happy with the relationship they're in. The women don't want to be with the men don't want to, they're all complaining to us. They're with these people, you know, they're married, they're going together, they're living together, and they're not happy with each other. And that's what they're all talking to us about. And God looks at Max and he says, and is there anything else, Max? And Max says, oh yeah, yeah, there's this one other thing, God. And God says, and what's that? He says, there's this one lunatic in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And he gets on his knees every single night. And he simply says, thanks. And God looks to Max. And he says, you know what, Max? Let's give that guy anything he wants. Thanks for listening.